Ilan Pappé is a senior lecturer in the University of Haifa Department of Political Science and chair of the Emil Tuma Institute for Palestine Studies in Haifa. His books include, among others, The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, London and New York, 1992, The Israeli-Palestinian Question, 1999, History of Modern Palestine, The Modern Middle East, and Forthcoming Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Today, he is one of the brave Israelis actively working to bring an end to Israel's war in Lebanon, as he has been working for years to end Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Welcome, Ilan Pappé.
It's a pleasure to be on your show, Jeffrey.
It's a pleasure, but this is hard, hard times. In today's New York Times front page is a headline, "Leaving Little Middle Ground, Left or Right, Israelis Are Pro-War." And Stephen Erlinger writes, "As Israel's war with Hezbollah finishes a fourth difficult week, domestic criticism of its prosecution is growing, yet there's a paradoxical effect as well. The harder the war has been, the more the public wants it to proceed. The criticism is not that the war is going on, but that it's going poorly. The public wants the army to hit Hezbollah harder so it will not threaten Israel again." Is that about the way it is at the moment?
I think basically, Jeffrey, this is a fair analysis of the mood in Israel. And it's not a bad analysis of how the common Israeli logic in the public and in the political system works when everybody realizes that the military effort is going astray. I mean, in most normal societies, failures of military operations would lead people to think of alternative activity, namely seeking diplomatic avenues. But in Israel, it works the other way around. When the military effort is not going well, first of all, people are dealing only with tactical issues. Maybe the commanders on the spot are not good enough. Maybe the military might was not exploited usefully. And secondly, a more chauvinistic and nationalist mood prevails that pushes for more extreme use of power and less what they call a less inhibited policy of destruction.
Well, it's interesting. Also, the question of wars in Israel are always just seem to be described as wars of choice or wars not of choice. And now the paper also describes, whereas 1982 was a war of choice, this is considered to be a war of survival. And that seems to be, from this standpoint, totally blown out of proportion given Israel's military power and compared to what Hezbollah has and Lebanon has.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about the casus belli, the cause for this war, which was an abduction of two soldiers, I mean, the strongest military in the Middle East and one of the strongest armies in the world has lost two soldiers. This can hardly constitute an existential threat to a state. So definitely, this is a war of choice. This is an intentional war. I'm not sure whether the timing is exactly the one that they've chosen, but definitely the Israelis, ever since 2001, were looking for a military operation with which they would destroy the power of the Hamas in Palestine, the Hezbollah in Lebanon, and go on from there to attack Syria and Iran. And this is not just a war of choice for Israel. This is a war of choice for the United States that definitely has pushed Israel into this operation, encouraged it to take it on. And we can see the double game that the American administration is playing in the United Nations with an effort to allow Israel enough time to complete an operation. The only good thing that has happened is that the operation is really stuck in military terms, and I think even the Americans are not sure anymore what they want. Do they want the Israelis to continue, but they cannot trust them anymore to complete the job, or would they like to finish it now before it has repercussions not only for Israel's position in the Middle East, but also for the American position in it?
Well, it seems obvious that the UN resolution, which was crafted by the U.S. and France and with Israeli complicity and also with the work of John Bolton, who Israeli Ambassador Dan Gilliman is described as a six-man in Israel's UN office, was clearly designed to be refused by Lebanon and Hezbollah. I mean, and which would give Israel more time. You see
that? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the Israeli press here does not deny it, and neither do the Israeli foreign ministry. They say that luckily we have America again on our side, that the resolution was drafted in such a way that would allow Israel to continue the military operation. And, you know, a few hours ago, the Israeli cabinet has decided in an overwhelming majority to expand the military operation according to the army's wishes. And when ministers were asked, but how would the army, and one should add that the army said that it needs 30 days, it needs a month from today to complete the military operation. And when a minister here was asked, but what about the diplomatic efforts? Can they not stop this operations before they are completed? And the minister said without any hesitation, for that we have the Americans.
Well, this seems to have been the conclusion Israel has drawn, particularly in 1982 from the invasion of Lebanon, which in the first few weeks of the war killed up to 17,000 Lebanese and Palestinian civilians, a figure that is not only not mentioned anywhere these days, but one would see from reading the American press and hearing the American radio that actually Israel as the occupier was somehow the victim in 1982. And America has actually given Israel a sense of license to kill.
Absolutely. I mean, this was one of the most astonishing side of the Israeli representative in the United Nations speech yesterday, talking about as if Israel and Lebanon coexisted next to each other in a history of peace and coexistence without any invasions and wars. And luckily the Lebanese representative was there to remind him that actually the Israelis occupied Lebanon for 18 years, which is, by the way, one of the reasons that the Hezbollah is so popular in the south of Lebanon. Because if you look at the story of Lebanon from 1948 onwards, including the 48 war when Israel occupied, people forget it, but in 1948 Israel occupied southern Lebanon and held it for a few months and oppressed the people there and subjected them to quite horrendous activity, including two massacres, one of them in the village of Hula, which is today destroyed by the Israeli Air Force. Now, if you look at that history from 48 onwards, you see again and again Israeli invasions into Lebanon, an occupation, and a very weak Lebanese army that cannot stop the Israeli invasions. And the south, which is the victim of these invasions, is mostly Shiite. And therefore, when they decided to have their own military resistance movement in order to resist these Israeli invasions, it looks natural for people in Lebanon that someone there at least is trying to defend them. And nobody in Lebanon looks at the Hezbollah as a terrorist organization or as a proxy of Iran and all the other things. This is really the only body, the only armed body that is trying to protect southern Lebanon that has been more under Israeli occupation than being an integral part of the sovereign state of Lebanon.
It's also interesting to contemplate, if Lebanon had its own army and military, where would the weapons come from? If they would come from Syria or Iran, obviously that would not be tolerated. So they would have to come from the West, which would then put Lebanon under America's thumb.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the distorted picture of the regional balance of power, which comes out in the Western media and here in the Israeli media, is such that it turns every aggressive American and Israeli policy in the past into an act of defense against terror, before that against communism, and now against pan-Islamism, whereas people forget how active were both America and Israel in intervening in the politics of these countries, toppling down regimes they didn't like, changing governments by force, and creating such mistrust among these people towards Israel and the West, and a lot of admiration for those who were willing to stand for the people and defend them.
Well, actually, you mentioned a moment before about the Lebanese ambassador in the UN. The problem is, like what you just said, none of this gets reported in American media. It's like there's a blanket of silence. There has been no report, for example, other than on Democracy Now, alternative media, of the 5,000 people who marched against the war in Tel Aviv last Saturday. According to the New York Times today, there have been several small marches of no more than 100 people. That's the New York Times, the same article today.
It's amazing how similar is the way the Israeli mainstream and American mainstream media conduct themselves. The most popular TV channel is the Channel 2, and its boss had said openly he is not going to allow anyone with opposing views to appear on TV. He does not want the TV to show any of the damage that the Israeli jets are causing or inflicting in Lebanon, and he turned it into kind of a military station. So the Israeli public doesn't really know. It's true that maybe many of them probably don't want to know, but they really do not see the pictures of what is. I'm not sure what would happen had they seen it, but my guess is that at least a section of the population, which is more sensitive, which is more reasonable, would have reacted differently had they been able to see beyond the screen of censorship that is imposed by the Israeli mainstream media.
One of the things that occurred to me, just change the subject slightly, but it does have something to do with the feeling of the Israeli population, is I've noticed in Israel, I was impressed or depressed when I first went there back in 83, to see the way the army, the military is idolized. It's like the heart and soul of the state. To go into a bookstore, a magazine store, and see all these books and magazines about various Israeli units, tanks, armors, planes, the Golani Brigade, and so on. And in just a spate of a couple of weeks for Palestinians and then Hezbollah to capture Israeli soldiers in two brilliantly conducted raids, this humiliation seemed to be something that struck at the core of what Israel's all about, and that even we know they had plans to invade Lebanon, that this was something that Israel could not tolerate.
Indeed, and I think it shows two things. One, how militaristic the society here is, and indeed the only historical model one can think of is Prussia, where the army was admired to that extent and had such a standing in the society, and quite often you feel in Israel that it is an army with a state rather than a state that possesses an army. And secondly, I think that indeed this comes back to what the Israelis call their power of deterrence. They really think that because the Palestinian guerrilla movement or the Lebanese guerrilla movement succeeded in abducting soldiers, that the Israeli deterrence power has been severely undermined, and that they would regain this power of deterrence by grinding Lebanon to dust, and they're doing similar things in the Gaza Strip. This is a total misunderstanding, of course, about what motivates Palestinians, Lebanese, other people in the Arab world and the Muslim world to stand against Israel, to confront Israel. This has nothing to do with Israel's power of deterrence. Nobody in the Arab world doubts the military power of Israel. What are they amazed at is at the way that the Israelis conduct themselves like a thug in a neighborhood, with all the impertinence that goes with it, the show of force and so on. It doesn't impress anyone in the Arab world. It doesn't mean that nobody knows in the Arab world how powerful the Israelis are. It just convinces Arabs, wherever they are, and Muslims, wherever they are, that they are dealing with a very aggressive entity that happens to grow inside their own world. And rather than saying to themselves, we should not deal with this entity, they keep saying to themselves, we cannot solve any of our problems as long as this aggressiveness continues and prevails.
Now, it's interesting. You have been a pretty good predictor, as far as I'm concerned. You predicted that the Israelis, when they left Gaza, it took the settlers out of Gaza, I should say, this would allow Israel to conduct military operations unimpeded, which they have, and which, of course, have been off the press. The world's press since the war in Lebanon began. But you also made a prediction in another interview we made that each successive intifada has gotten more violent. And we see the comparison of this war in Lebanon with 1982, where Israel within a couple of weeks was at the door of Beirut, and when they really found no military resistance to speak of, some of the refugee camps, but 80,000 soldiers just marched right up the highway to Beirut. And here we have a situation where the Israeli army has obviously failed in its mission, and another war such as this could be even more catastrophic.
Yes, indeed, and I think, unfortunately, these predictions, in a way, are easy to make, because all you need is to have the courage to say to yourselves and others, it's going to be worse, which is not something a political activist like to tell people. You would like to tell people that something good can happen, and especially if they would be active enough, this would happen. But I think it's unfortunately not true about the short-term future in this region. There are two options here in many ways. One is that now that the Israeli cabinet has decided to go on a full-scale war with, and it's getting any green light it needs from the government to put as many soldiers as it wants into Lebanon, there are two possibilities. One is that the Israelis would say to themselves after 3 or 4 weeks, we have won, whether it's true or not, it doesn't matter. And then we are facing a real danger that the Israelis would feel that they now can tackle, or attack rather, Syria, Damascus, and maybe even Iran. Or, and this is the second possibility, that it will not succeed. And even the Israeli politicians would admit that militarily they have not succeeded in achieving the goals in Lebanon. And then what happens in Israel in such situations, we had it in 1973, when Israelis feel that they have failed militarily, they would elect a more right-wing government, which would escalate the Israeli actions against the Palestinians in the occupied territories, and maybe even against the Palestinians inside Israel itself. So we are really in a juncture where the options, as the Israeli leadership see it, are catastrophic any way you look at it. I mean, the only hope is that soon after the American elections, but I'm not sure it will happen, but soon after the American elections, something would change in the international community approach to the problem. Because if you will wait for a strong movement from inside Israel, or for the Arab world to do something, we will have to wait very, very long. And in the meantime, the destruction would be enormous. So in the short term, it looks as if it's not so much a matter of a third intifada as much as an escalation that in any scenario one looks at it would be catastrophic to the people living in this region.
Well, one of the things that also occurred to me was that the Israeli army and the publicity always talks about elite brigades, this elite brigade, but they got the reputation in 1967 and 73 when Israel actually fought in wars against regular armies, and the Israeli army in the last several decades has mainly been an occupying army. This is not conducive, speaking objectively, for fighting a war against a serious rival. As a matter of fact, there are many quotes from Israeli soldiers who say that Hezbollah is actually a very strongly well-trained fighting force, and that they have not been able to gain ground. And actually, the results, Nasrallah says in Beirut seems to have more veracity than what the Israeli spokesmen were saying in the early weeks of the war.
Indeed, again, here one of the two aspects one should highlight. One is the fact that in the last 6 years, these elite units were stationed in the occupied territories, chasing children, women, and old men in the lanes and alleys of the cities of the occupied West Bank and before the Gaza Strip. And they can hardly say that they have gained any experience in fighting a proper military units or resistance movement. And I think that the Israeli army is paying now the price for turning its elite units into a police force. and a very brutal police force at that. Secondly, I think that something is breaking down in the Israeli mythology here, for sure. Not only because the elite units are facing a very determined and very efficient resistance movement, for the first time, one should say, in the wars between Israel and Arab forces ever since 1948, but also because of the clear imbalance between the Goliath, which is Israel, and the David, which is the Hezbollah. I mean, the one thing that the Israeli press finds very difficult to tackle is this double-edged sword, if you want. On the one hand, it's very clear that Israel is the Goliath here. I mean, you cannot play against it. It doesn't work anymore. It's not a David. And for the Israelis, who were always, or in many junctures in history, Goliath, but at least they were sort of covering it with mythology, this is very difficult. And secondly, as indeed the Israelis were learned in their own mythology, it is the David that succeeds in tackling the Goliath of the past. And any way you look at it, they cannot get out of this imagery, and it doesn't even work. They tried at first to demonize Hezbollah, and especially Hassan Nasrallah, and so on, but it doesn't work. It really doesn't work with the kind of commitment and determination and courage that is shown by the Hezbollah fighters on the ground.
Well, I'll tell you, in the American media, National Public Radio, and then listening to BBC this morning, very early this morning, they are trying to cast Israel as the David. And in Robin Lustig of BBC was interviewing Avi Shalit, the writer for Haaretz, who had described Olmert as speaking in Churchillian terms and tones, and they both agreed that this was a Churchillian period, as if Hezbollah was the Nazis. It's extraordinary to listen to it at 5 in the morning here, to hear this interview, and one interview after another with Israeli journalists, all of whom strongly favor the war and portray this as a war of survival and of necessity. And it's extraordinary. This is what the media is broadcasting to the West.
Indeed, and I think that this is always the last resort for the Israelis, and I wonder how long can they continue to use and overuse it. When they run out of arguments, when they really have very little to justify, they immediately immediately take out of their drawers the imagery of Nazis and Jews and portraying Nasrallah as Hitler. If you remember, they did the same in 1982, when even, as you mentioned yourself, even a weaker force was facing them in 1982. Arafat was immediately compared to Hitler and his bunker to Hitler's bunker and so on. I think what the Israelis find, that apart from Lustig and of course mainstream media in America, in the other parts of the world, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Look at Chavez in Venezuela.
Yes.
In fact, the images that are conjured in the minds of people is, if when they start to think about the Second World War, is much more thinking about the Israel as the German war machine, and on the Lebanese as the Jewish people, or at least the people of Europe who were occupied. And I think the Israelis are playing a very dangerous game here, because they should have. They never did. They should have left the Holocaust alone. They should really have left it as a sui generis, as a unique example of human violence, brutality, and crimes that is not comparable to anything. They should have left it. But they've used it and overused it to describe anyone they don't like and dislike. And therefore, people are now using it freely also to describe them. And so it's like a brand in many ways.
Well, actually, some people have depicted the bombing of Lebanon as a number of Guernicas in Spain.
Indeed, and the pictures of the west, the southern neighborhoods of Beirut do remind us of the cities destroyed in the Second World War by heavy bombardment, as they did in 1982.
one of the differences between 1982 and this year is in 1982, when Israel invaded Lebanon, there had been an ongoing civil war. So much of, for example, central Beirut had been destroyed or was full of bullet holes from the civil war, the various militias. And I was there in 83. I could see the difference where whole apartment houses had been wrecked by missiles from the air, as opposed to street fighting in central Beirut. But all of Lebanon had been rebuilt, and this now is such a major tragedy that they have about a week of fuel left. Okay. The questioner was saying that in 67 they had Syria was on the border and Egypt was on the border. And you should be fighting. Why are you out there fighting for Israel? That you and I are half Arab.
Okay.
Maybe you can explain quickly 67 and how what that was all about. People here, by the way, including the editorial page editor of the Newsweek magazine, will write in her book that Egypt attacked Israel in 1967.
Well, yes, one would fear that in the history books of the next 20 years, it would say that Lebanon has attacked Israel. People forget that Israel, of course, launched the war in 1967, initiated the war. It was part of an Israeli policy to complete what the Israeli prime ministers at the time called the job of 1948, namely to take the remaining 20% of Palestine Israel had not occupied in 1948. It's amazing how the mythology of the Arab-Israeli war still prevails in the United States. We did, and I say we because I was one of the historians who successfully debunked the mythology of 1948, so at least people do not talk anymore of a voluntary flight of Palestinians and of a brave Israel confronting the huge Arab army trying to invade it, and rather looking at 48 as an ethnic cleansing operation. Similarly, about 67, it's time now to look afresh at the events there. But in any case, this is 2006, and Egypt is silent and said it will not interfere in the war. Jordan is silent. In fact, the Arab regimes are shamefully silent and inactive while Palestinians and Lebanese are being slaughtered. And thirdly, I'm not half Arab. In fact, I'm proper Jew, not that it matters much. Both my parents came from Germany, survived the Holocaust, and as a Holocaust survivor and a father to children in Israel, I want to fight for Israelis, Jews, Palestinians, and so on by trying to avert, to try and stop this escalating war from destroying all of us.
Well, thank you for that. We have another caller on the line. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for this refreshing program. I'm hoping you could shed an opinion on what I'm noticing in the news, which is that consistently and repeatedly, both Hamas and Hezbollah are always tagged terrorist organizations. You rarely see Hamas referred to as a democratically elected governing force. And yet there's never any comparison made where much of the world would see the CIA as a terrorist force, and certainly the School of the Americas has been a terrorist force. I wonder if, and I'm not asking this from a naive place, but I'm wondering if there's any way amongst ourselves we can begin to change that discussion and have a little more internal view that's more in keeping with the world view of what this country represents in the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, caller.
Yes. Yes, I think it's a good idea. I think that the way forward to doing it is really employ the most basic international laws of common sense, of morality and ethics, and just judge governments, secret services, and armies as we judge organizations which don't happen to be state organizations because they're not allowed to have a proper state in the case of Lebanon, not to have a state at all in the case of Palestine. And then when you, for example, in the case of Israel and Hamas, you compare the power of destruction and the terror inflicted by Israel on the Palestinians compared to the terror inflicted by the Hamas on Israel, you can see how different the proportion is and who is really the great villain there. And secondly, I think it's also very important to explain to people that Hamas and Hezbollah are also social organization, cultural organization. These are movements that have roots in their own societies, that they have taken care of welfare and poverty issues because there was no one else to do that, that they have protected the self-identity and honor of and dignity of people under oppression and occupation when nobody else was doing it. I myself am an atheist, and I'm on the left, and I wish the leftist movement would have led both the Palestinians and the Lebanese and the Israelis, but we have to face it. The only proper movements that dare to resist American imperialism today and the Israeli occupying and expanding policies are these movements, and hopefully more people on the secular side, on the leftist side, on the humanist side as well will join these forces so that we can create something better out of the place we're living in.
Certainly in Lebanon, people who may have been critical of Hezbollah before are now, the 80% of the Lebanese are behind Hezbollah. We have a board lit up, so let's go to the next caller. Hello, you're on the air. Another caller on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to ask the professor, how do you understand as an Israeli the animus coming out of Israel and in relation to never again, you know, the incredible suffering of the Jewish people? How do you see that, and what can you see as the possibility for changing this so that the humanity can be the wisdom that can come from the suffering of a people? If you could share your thoughts on that, I'd appreciate it.
Did you hear that?
I think that I'll try and answer it if because I hardly heard it, but I think it was powerful enough. So I heard it. I think that that one should really distinguish between the legacy of Judaism as a civilization, as a culture and a religion, which is a history of suffering and so on, which led many Jews to stand at the forefront in the struggle for civil rights in the United States and against apartheid in South Africa and other worthy causes. And Zionism, which has really reduced the Judaism or the Jewish legacy into something else, which has turned Judaism into an ideology of ethnicity, of ethnic supremacy, by which Jews feel that the only lesson they can learn from the Holocaust is to have a kind of an apartheid state in Israel and an aggressive policy towards its neighbors. I do hope that the more moral and universal values and legacies of Judaism will come to the fore also in the Middle East and among American Jews, one should hasten to add, and would allow us to build together with our Muslim and Christian friends in Palestine and in Lebanon a better world and a better future.
Thank you. We have a couple more callers. Let's go. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't know where to begin.
Well, begin quickly because we have other callers.
I think that we need to be more critical of our own community, myself coming from the Jewish community, and that we need to really not subscribe to the party line about anything going back to the Holocaust. Because once you set up some event that is sacrosanct and you can't question that, then you set yourself up as the authority about everything subsequently. So I think the way that the Jews have set themselves up to be uncriticizable about anything is going to lead to their downfall.
Thank you for that comment. Professor Pepe, Ilan?
Yes, I think there's a great danger for Jews around the world, especially for the American Jews, if this double standard will continue. I mean, this what is so strong in my country, the sense that because of the Holocaust, you are immune from any criticism. I used to describe it as a kind of a bank account, a moral bank account, which I think we have overdrawn now for many, many years.
Especially because Norman Finkelstein has debunked much of the, you know, hype about and the excuse of the Holocaust for subsequent Israeli actions.
Yes, but and I agree, but I think it's... It's much more than that. I think it has a lot to do with the third world, in particular, watching a country that is dealt with velvet gloves when it commits the same crimes that other countries in the world are paying very badly if their regimes are pursuing these policies. And if people around the world, Jewish communities around the world, would blindly support Israel, despite what it's doing, they will be blamed later on for these policies, especially in the United States. And this is a grave danger for not only the Jews who live in Israel, but also the Jews who live around the world, especially in the United States.
Indeed, we need to speak out more. Thank you.
I don't support what Israel is doing either, but I was wondering, I have not heard you mention anything about the missiles that are going into Israel.
Okay, Professor Pepe?
About the missiles?
Yeah, yes.
Yes, yes. I think that this is a terrible situation for the Israelis in the north. I'm talking to you from a house that was nearly hit by a missile. But, you know, on the missiles, I learn a lot from my Palestinian friends, as probably your listener knows. In the north, half of the population are Palestinians, and many of the people killed by the missiles were Palestinians and not Jews, actually. And I learned from them the amazing position that they have. On the one hand, the sorrow for those who die. On the second, without contradicting the solidarity they feel with the people victimized in Lebanon. And thirdly, without losing the cold political analysis, which we know what is the source of all this trouble, both here in the north and on the other side of the border. It's the aggressive policies of Israel. If we stop them, you stop the missiles flying into here, and you stop the destruction of Lebanon, and you can start doing something else here.
Thank you for that answer. True, Hezbollah has said if Israel stops, we stop, and Israel will not stop even if Hezbollah stops. You come toward the end of the hour. You have a website.
Yes.
Which you can please give to our audience, because I know the board has been lit up here today, and we have still lit up. We don't have any time for more calls, but what is that website where people can read your articles and get a hold of your books?
Right. It's www.ilanpappe.org.
Ilan, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today again on Takes on the World. And I admire your courage, one of the brave Israelis who are not afraid to speak the truth. Thanks so much for being our guest today. I look forward to our next conversation. Take care.
Good day, Jeffrey. Thank you very much.